Information of optional demographic information is appreciated. To participate in KPFT focus groups this month, just visit kpft.org. It's smart to act now, as there are invitation-only gatherings. Thank you. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Unruffled Beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals Thursday, 10 p.m., and it's time for So What's Your Story. We are live, and we're the only show originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, right here, only on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubicek, Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Houston Downtown, and Shannon McKerchie, working the boards and doing everything else, frankly. Thank God you're back, Shannon. I hope that you read the words that Shannon wrote on our Facebook page, because words alone cannot thank you enough for your donations during our recent winter fund drive. But, you know, because of you, we exceeded our goal on So What's Your Story, where every week guest storytellers from our community take us on astonishing journeys with poignant narratives and enchanting folktales before returning us safely to the present. I've learned that we are born into life as a blank page, and we leave life as a full book. Our lives are our story, and our story is our life. It's our desire to communicate a story that makes the story and us inextricably connected. When this connection takes place, we become an agent not of performance, but of authenticity. To be authentic is to be true. And what's truer than truth? Well, according to Hasidic wisdom, it's the story. It's the raw, uncompromising truth found in the lies we live is tonight's theme. And my guest speaks of being true to her own purpose. Dr. Rochelle Duty practices academic medicine, diagnosing and treating people with memory disorders. Her research relates to developing approaches for the prevention and treatment for conditions such as Alzheimer's. The eclectic Dr. Duty is also a story writer and teller who recently returned to both in public forums after years of informal telling. She is a Moth Story Slam winner and a mother of four kids about whom plenty of stories, I'm sure, can be told. Rochelle, welcome. I'm glad you're here.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, after all the emails, you know, these are like my best friends. Every week I email people, and I'm sure I nudged you to death after 38 emails, right? But I'm so glad you're here. It's really an honor. And you are a Moth Slam winner. We've had a lot of those on. You guys are pretty good tellers. Pretty good tellers. What inspired you to walk into the Moth to begin with?
Well, you know, I used to write stories in a really serious way, short stories. And for many years, I didn't have time. When I decided to get back to that, I thought the Moth would be a perfect way to do it.
What was the theme the night that you won? What was your winning tale theme?
The theme was rivalry.
Rivalry. Tell us a little bit about what you talked about.
Well, I talked about being sort of an unwitting rival to a fellow resident in training, and the 16 years of time over which this rivalry worked itself out.
Yeah, that was great. What is it about telling stories in public, Rochelle, that you find so gratifying? Because you do something so different for a living. And now you love telling stories. But what is it about telling stories in public?
Well, telling stories just amazes me that you can get in front of a group of people and talk about something that mattered to you or that moved you or touched you, and watch it have an effect on everyone. And that's exhilarating to me.
Yeah, some people think that stories are simply transformative. They transform you. They change you. You believe that?
I think they do change us. They change us a little bit at a time.
Yeah. They make us feel and think things that we've never felt and thought before. That's for sure. I know that every time we tell a story, I think we become a better person. I do. I think that we see things that we haven't saw before. Does that make any sense?
Oh, I think so. But I think every time we listen to a story, it also makes us a better person.
Yeah. Your story tonight is about your first trip to Asia, a trip that you took wearing two distinct hats as a neurologist and a student of anthropology, and you've broken the story into a couple of parts. So why don't you go ahead and start it off?
Well, this story starts right after I had finished my neurology training, but my education hadn't stopped. I knew I needed to know more about the brain and the mind, and I was a graduate student in cognitive anthropology. During my studies, I came across the idea of orality and literacy, and this idea just caught hold of me. So people like Walter Ong wrote about oral cultures that didn't have writing to refer to, and they spoke and thought and organized their lives in a different way. And then Scribner and Cole and Goody and people like that, they talked about a great divide, an historical divide, between a world that was oral and organized around sound and a world that was visual, organized around words. Most importantly, there was a Russian neuropsychologist named Luria who went to Uzbekistan, and he actually started interacting with people who didn't have a written language and asking them how things went together or didn't go together or why they thought a certain sequence of events would take place. And he suggested that people actually think differently if they don't have a written language. So I became very urgent about this. The orality and literacy studies clearly showed that if you didn't read and write, but you lived in a literate society, you adopt the ways of thinking of literate people. So true orality or oral cultures were disappearing all over the world. There were only two places left where you could go, the Igbo in Nigeria or the Karen Hill Tribe people in Thailand. So I decided to design almost an experiment and to go to northern Thailand, find non-literate Karen Hill Tribes people and interact with them using standardized types of tests like intelligence tests and things that I had adapted to their culture. The plan was to start with very remote villages that had no contact with literacy, move to villages that had some contact, do the same tests and have the same discussions with people, and really try to understand the different degrees of literacy and how they shaped our thought. Once I got to Thailand, the project had to be recreated. With each new person that I met, I would explain what I was there to do, and it didn't make sense to them. So if I spoke to an urban planner, it was different than if I spoke to the president of a university, or eventually the various elders of the Karen Baptist Mission, who knew the most about the Karen people. And each time I would tell them, well, what I was trying to understand, I would have to reshape the story and rethink how I was going to find out. So that was the preparation. Eventually, I was able to translate the psychological tests with the help of other people into both Thai and into the oral language, Karen, which really didn't have a writing system. And after a couple of attempts, because he kept turning me down, I talked one of the guides in Chiang Mai, who worked in the Thai-German bakery, into being my guide and going with me to the remote western region of Thailand near the Burmese border.
Wonderful. That's fascinating. And one of the things that I know that you had shared with me while we were emailing is that literate people, when they write, or writing for literate people, gives them a sense of certitude. Yeah.
Yes, I think that I'll illustrate that.
Yeah, yeah. Looking forward to that. Tell us about cognitive anthropology. How'd you conceptualize that? We know what cultural is and physical, but cognitive anthropology, what is that exactly?
Well, there have been many practitioners of it, anthropologists who are interested in what you might call cultural relativism, or the ways in which being in a certain culture makes you different, mm-hmm. makes you mm-hmm. think differently, makes you use different words or organize things differently. And, you know, there are many predecessors to that, but the cognitive anthropologist also took learnings out of cognitive psychology. Mm-hmm. There was a really great individual in this field, Steven Tyler, who was my dissertation director.
Was he really?
Yes. So I learned a great deal from him and from linguists and people who had tried to apply cognitive science, mm-hmm. but to be informed by the differences between cultures.
So your PhD is in cognitive anthropology.
Yes.
Right. What was the name of, what was the title of your dissertation?
It was really about aphasia, or disordered language due to brain injury.
Yeah. It's amazing how science, neurology and social science are so inextricably related. I know that doesn't sound very profound, but some people don't think of it that way.
Well, that's why I went, because I didn't want to study more neurology. Yeah. I wanted to study the world in which it existed.
Yeah, you're a good example of the consummate scholar, a person who, the more I know, the less I know, right?
Yeah, right.
Right, and that's beautiful. I'm Hank Rubicek with Sharon McKerchy, and you are enjoying my guest storyteller, Dr. Rochelle Dooney, on So What's Your Story? Only on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 90.3 for our friends in Livingston, or kpft.org if you're listening online. But whether you're online, in line, out of line, or my God, even if you're in a lineup, I'm really thrilled that you're with us. Let's get back to Thailand.
Okay, so I had convinced a guide to go with me. Mm-hmm. He was in an awkward position for a guide because he'd never been to that part of Thailand. But he thought that the project was important, and important to the Karen people, and he was Karen, though he lived in Chiang Mai. So we left Chiang Mai with some pretty vague directions. It turns out that although everybody knew there were remote hill tribes people who didn't have much contact with literate people, they didn't know where they were exactly. So we were told to drive southwest toward Mae Sariang, and then 50 kilometers before we got there, we should turn south into a mountainous but forested area. And rumor was that there was a guest house there. So we did this during the rainy season in Thailand. It rains every day. We found ourselves in the middle of the night with no lighting of any kind, driving on a winding mountainous road with potholes bigger than the car. If I'd known how dangerous it was, I'm not sure we would have driven it, but I couldn't see, so I didn't know until we left. We eventually came to an area where it looked like there were domesticated animals, so we parked the car and got out and started calling in Thai and in Karen. We're looking for a guest house. Miraculously, a man walked out of the night, and we could tell by the clothing he wore that he was a Lawa tribesman. All of the hill tribes make their own cloth, and you can tell by the pattern on the cloth what tribe it is. And we explained to him in gestures and in Thai that we wanted to find Karen people and we needed a guest house. He took us to a structure that was a balcony up on stilts, divided into cubicles that were open to the outside but covered on the top and on three sides, and each one had a mosquito net. That was our guest house room. We slept there, and by dawn the next day, he had found someone who was willing to walk us to the remote Karen tribal village. Now, that walk was about 4.5 or 5 hours, but I didn't know that starting out. And in fact, I hadn't given much thought at all to the idea of actually trekking to where I had to go. We started walking across rice paddies. And you would think, oh, that's not so difficult, unless you've tried it, because a rice paddy is really composed of squares of mud with water in between and delicate plants, and the only way to traverse a rice paddy is to put your foot exactly in the right spot on the wall of the little square with each step. So that was pretty exhausting for about a mile, and it only got worse after that. We started walking uphill, and the hills were made of slippery red clay, and it was pouring down rain. And my Lawa guide was so much better at it than I was that he was usually far in the distance, and I couldn't even see him unless he turned a corner or got up at a higher altitude. So most of the time, I couldn't see him as I followed him. My Chiang Mai guide was not as adept, and he was also carrying the equipment, the video camera, the t-shirts that I brought to give to the men I would interview, and the kami ramen soups for the women. And he was so far behind me that I couldn't see him either. So most of this five-hour walk, I did pretty much on my own. We made our way up hills, through vegetation, forded some rivers that had leeches in them. I'd never seen a leech before. And eventually, miraculously, we all three met up in the same spot and entered a village. And our instructions were to find the headman's house, which turned out to be easy. It was just the biggest platform on stilts. Now, I went to several villages, but I'm only going to mention the first one, which was the most remote. We were invited to climb up into one of these structures, and we told them through my Karen translator that I was a doctor from America who had come here to talk to them about how they think. And that, of course, made everyone laugh. But everybody was interested. And pretty soon, the house was filled with a representative from almost every household in the village. There were probably 60 or 70 families there. And as I would be testing someone, they were also bringing all the sick people, because they hadn't had a doctor there in many years. So I hadn't anticipated it, but everybody who needed medical help was coming into the structure as well. So I was giving psychological tests and videotaping, but also keeping an eye on my supplies, because they liberally looked through them, and interrupting the interviews every once in a while to examine a baby or talk to a couple who were concerned about a sick woman. So eventually, the project did get done. I have a few observations that really go across all the different villages and all the different places I went. The first one was that almost nobody had any cognitive difficulties. You know, the tests that we use in this country to screen people to see if they've got any cognitive problems. When I translated that into appropriate questions for Karen people, everybody made a perfect score, except for two people. One of them, I think she had an alcohol-related dementia, and one of them was a young man who I'm pretty sure had trisomy 21 or Down syndrome. Everybody else was intact. The second thing that struck me was the use of symbolism. One man who lived in a village and knew people who could read and write, but he did not do so himself, he told me, "That's good for my son and for other people like him, but I don't really need it. If I have a message I want to tell my wife, I send her a flower. And she knows by the color of flower what my message is." That took me right back to middle school and Carnation Day, when we would send each other colored flowers and a note that was either signed or not signed to let you know what you thought of the person. And then finally, I realized what it means to have a written system of keeping track of what is said. So the difference between orality and literacy. The existence of writing gives literate people a lot of certitude about themselves and their worldview. If you're literate and you say something like, "I'm going to tell you three things," you and I will both know whether or not I told you all three things. But oral people don't think of telling as things. They could never understand if you said something like that. And similarly, if I say to you, "No, I didn't say that," we might argue back and forth about did I say it or didn't I. But oral people wouldn't even be familiar with the concept. Once it's said, it's not right or wrong, or it doesn't have to match what you think you said. That's only because we know that it can be written down. It's almost legalistic. In the end, by the time this was finished, I was very glad to be headed back to Chiang Mai. I came out of the jungle on a day that turned out to be a national holiday with Christmas lights everywhere and balloons and flowers. It was the Queen's birthday, but it was also my birthday. And I decided to keep that to myself. I wasn't really sure, you know, what it would mean to share the birthday with the Queen. I was grateful for my experience there, for a glimpse of what thought without writing is like. And also, this was my first lesson of many in staying true to my purpose, but not necessarily the way I had planned.
Very good. Thank you. Boy, there's so much there. So much there. How do they gauge effective dialogue if, for example, the words are not the things? Do you know what I'm saying? In other words, how do you gauge the effectiveness?
I don't think people worry about gauging effectiveness. Mm-hmm. I think it's more, I have a message to give. Mm-hmm. You're expected to be listened to.
Right.
But there's not worry about the precision of the message,
right,
or your responsibility in having delivered it or not delivered it.
We really are caught up on messages having to have a significant purpose. You're right. And I couldn't help thinking about, you know, low and high context cultures, that we are individuals in this country, at least most of us collectively, as very linear in our thoughts. We have to be organized. There has to be a purpose. There has to be some sort of bottom line result in terms of what we hear and what we are supposed to hear. And you're right. That's a fascinating thing. That really is, Rochelle. That is a fascinating thing. And what do you attribute to all of those perfect scores?
Well, the perfect scores were just on a test to see whether
right.
the person could keep track of time and
yeah.
remember. You know, it has a task in it that involves drawing something. Mm-hmm. Most of these people had never held, none of these people had ever held a pencil.
Wow. Unbelievable. You know, storytelling is such a revival, and there is no greater ambassador to storytelling than our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, which is hands down the best storytelling group in the state. Are you aware of a guild at all?
Absolutely.
Absolutely good. Are you really?
Yes, you told
me. I told you. See, there you go. Always, always the great responses. I love it. Well, they've been around a long time. And we hold monthly story swaps on the third Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Multi-Service Center at 1475 West Gray. Check out our brand new site. It really is terrific at www.houstonstorytellers.org for all of the fun happenings. And make sure you visit us on the So What's Your Story Facebook, because there you will find Shannon's snappy brilliant showering our page. And Shannon, what makes our page so incredibly special?
Well, we know Houston and storytelling, both features at the same time.
Yeah.
You can find articles such as storytelling and the way you to do a better job and make a stronger startup,
right,
as well as your segments on Why Telling Stories Matters by our good Dr. Hank.
Oh my gosh, are they really
yes.
on there? Yeah, I didn't think anybody cared or listened. I think you're the only one who cares. Maybe my mother reads it.
He was on Houston Matters earlier this week.
Oh yeah, yeah,
and of course, upcoming storytelling events around town.
Everybody is just looking for my autograph, Shannon. Right? People say, Houston, what? I know. Thank you. Thank
You're
you
so welcome.
Much. And we also hear about all of our fabulous guests, and we do have fabulous guests. And of course, Dr. Duty is one of them, and she's sitting right next to me. And make sure that you like us on the way out. My gosh, make sure you get those thumbs up. Next week is our Valentine show, and we're going to be putting the spotlight on frequent guest and fun favorite, Alan Gardner Atkinson. He is really fun. He is fun. And a fan favorite, I might add, as well. He's a spectacular teller that you're not going to want to miss. But you know what? You're not going to want to miss any of the shows. We've got some great things coming up this year on So What's Your Story? And for good reason, because our guests rock every week on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. Rochelle, you know, on a lot of shows, I've made a point to talk about the healing power of stories. And, you know, everybody has an opinion about that. I've been keeping journals forever, and I find them to be almost habitual. I can't be without them, because they're all a bunch of episodes in my life, and they're all very critical. And I know that the stories promote good health on a number of levels, not to mention the fact that storytelling teaches us about vocabulary and cultural patterns and imagination and active listening and a plethora of other things. But, you know, I've observed people with some memory loss tell stories with great imagery and detail, and seeming to gain confidence as the story unfolds. And I know that this is really an unfair question to ask a person like you, because you know a great deal about this, but is there any merit behind stories enhancing memory?
Well, I think that, you know, there are a number of ways to look at that. Certainly, telling something in a story form helps us remember. And that's the lesson we learn from the oral cultures and the epics, like the Homeric epics, Iliad,
right.
the Odyssey.
Right.
But also, when you think about it, writers like Proust have a lot to tell us about memory. La recherche de temps perdu, the remembrance of things past. When he talks about objects causing people to remember, it's as if the memories are in the objects. It causes you to recreate. And I have thought about that because sometimes when people with memory problems are moved and they lose their possessions and they lose the things they're familiar with, they literally lose their memories. So I think there's an interaction between telling the stories and being stimulated by the world to remember the stories that you know.
I love what you're saying, and that is so true. I frequently tell the story about my grandfather on this show because he was a man of very few words, and he was in Dachau concentration camp, and he had a gold watch that he left for me. And, you know, the story is that he told me this story every year around my birthday. And I never even knew he had this watch, but the story is that he had this gold watch that he would keep in his sock while he was in Dachau concentration camp because it reminded him of hope that he would one day run across my mom and my grandmother again. And I tell this story frequently. I do, and for good reason. But and he was a young man, so he was able to keep his clothing and hide the watch. But the watch is what allowed him to remember things because he never really suffered from severe dementia or anything, thank goodness, but he did suffer from some memory loss, as you might imagine. And whenever he talked about the watch or whenever he talked about a physical heirloom, an artifact, somehow he sounded like a young man who understood all the detail as it unfolded in front of him. And I was always mesmerized by that because I just couldn't believe he'd be that eloquent and that precise with the detail. So what you say is so unbelievably true. It really is. You have some favorite stories growing up?
Oh, well, I liked to hear stories that people told about themselves and about the people that they knew.
Yeah.
Not so much the written stories when I was growing up. I discovered those later.
Yeah, you were raised in a storytelling home.
Not formally. I did have a grandmother who was very colorful. And her stories, though I missed a lot of the content, were very inspiring.
Yeah. I miss them a lot. I do. And it's revival is the word because you don't hear many stories anymore. People don't take the time to tell them because you have to listen to them. You have to listen to them. That's the one thing about a story. You can't get up. It's rude. And you have to listen to the entire message. And it's a really wonderful thing. You know, each of us have something to say and something to share. So you have to say it and share it with a story, I think. Unlike the metamorphosis that occurs to a butterfly or a frog, telling a story will probably not dramatically alter your character, physical structure, or even circumstance. However, as a storyteller, you can imagine it did. Thank you, Dr. Rochelle Duty, for a story with a landscape dotted with such introspection and insight. I appreciate it so much, and I hope that you'll agree to come back. I talked to you earlier about that, and I hope that you do. It was fun.
That'd
not
be great.
Too terrible,
well,
right?
Thank you.
It was really great. But don't any of you dare go away, and make sure you show up for a Valentine's show next week. You're not going to want to miss that. You are not. Just, you know, get your Russell Stofers and your Peeps and sit down and enjoy it. But Scooter is up next with The Inner Side to complete the back side of this power hour on KPFT. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, join us every Thursday at 10 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And ease into the weekend right. You keep loving a great story, and I'm going to keep bringing them to you. Be good to each other. I'm Dr. Hank, reminding you that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
For the month of February, 90.1 KPFT has been selected as one of the local nonprofits competing for your vote at Okra Charity Saloon in downtown Houston. The concept is simple. For each drink purchased, guests receive one vote that they may cast that night for their favorite organization. The charity with the most votes at the end of the month receives the next month's proceeds. Okra is located at 924 Congress, near the corner of Main Street and Congress. Again, throughout the month of February, KPFT is one of the candidates for support. You can chip in to vote with the purchase when you patronize Okra. You can visit Okra on